Fatima Bhutto, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
We've seen a massive outpouring of support for Palestine in your home country of Pakistan since the beginning of Israel's siege on Gaza. Protests in the tens of thousands have been held in cities all around the country with little sign of momentum slowing. Why do you think the people of Pakistan have been so outspoken in their support?
Pakistan has historically always supported Palestinian struggle and, of course, the ending of apartheid in Palestine. It's a relationship that goes back really to when both countries were made, in a sense. Pakistan is born in 1947 and Israel is created in 1948. But Pakistan has always had a communion with the Palestinian people. We see from the United States to the United Kingdom to most of Europe and beyond to countries like Pakistan that their people are wholeheartedly in favor of a permanent ceasefire, whereas the governments are not. We see people demanding certain action from their governments, which their governments are just ignoring. So I don't think we've ever seen a split so wide, and I don't think that's unique to just Pakistan. Of course, the Pakistani people have been protesting, like people all over the world, and I think this global movement will continue.
On December 7th, Israel killed the renowned Palestinian writer, academic, and activist Rifat El-Arir, as well as six of his family members. Over the past 3 months, Israel has killed more than 18,000 Gazans, wiping out entire families, in fact, wiping out entire bloodlines. And yet, El-Arir's killing specifically has elicited an outcry. Can you explain to us who he was and why his death is being felt so powerfully?
In the last 2 months, Israel has killed 89 journalists, I believe the number stands at. They've killed over 100 UN Relief Works Agency staff. They have killed Palestinian medics and health workers in the hundreds. And they have also killed writers, artists, musicians, children, newborns. All these deaths have been painful to watch. But Rifat was a voice of the horror that was unfolding. So many of us were following the airstrikes, the daily struggle to get food, the power cuts, the internet cuts, through Rifat's tweets, through his Instagram stories, and his will to survive, his poetry. He's talking about the impact of literature, the experience of writing that is one of the greatest human experiences because it bears testimony to survival, not just suffering. And I think as well, many of us know that this is really not just a war about October 7th. It's not just a war about Hamas. Because in that case, why are premature children being killed in neonatal wards? Why are doctors being killed? Why are journalists being killed? But why is a poet, as Rifat was, why is a poet and a translator and a Shakespeare scholar and a writer being targeted in his family home along with his siblings? It defies logic. It defies everything.
The pain of his death, for many observers, is compounded by what his death signifies in terms of the loss of art, the loss of culture, the loss of literature. Of course, as you mentioned, scientists have died, journalists have died, artists have died. Major cultural sites have been destroyed, churches, mosques. When people lose their art, when people lose their literature, when people lose their culture, what's at stake?
Everything is at stake. You're losing, it's a patrimony of culture, its heritage, its survival, its records. You know, when we talk about genocide, it's not just the absolute slaughter of a population. It also means removing them from records. It means removing testimony. It means removing art. It means removing poetry, removing music. It means erasing the lives of ordinary people. And I think when we talk about the destruction that we're seeing in Gaza, it is to reduce Gaza to nothing, to take not just homes, but also libraries, not just hospitals, but also universities, and let there be nothing. Let Gaza be not even a memory, a place that once was and never will be again, not even in the pages of books. And I think that is really what is so horrifying about this violence. You know, we know states are threatened by cultural figures. We know that writers are powerful because they hold power to account. They keep a record of violence, of terror, of these kind of nightmares. And that's why they kill them. That's why they've always killed them.
Art, literature, writers, as you just mentioned, not only hold power to account, they also create space for us to understand ideas in a different way. I'm thinking about your work, for example, your novel, The Runaways, allows us to understand through the lens of three young men who become effectively radicalized in Iraq. Through that lens, we're able to understand how complicated political violence is, how complicated the journey into quote-unquote radicalization is. There's no condoning of Hamas's killing of civilians. We're not justifying the ongoing treatment of hostages. You once said something that stuck with me. You said, even as I watched my characters do terrible things, I mourned the fact that they didn't have other choices. How does that idea speak to what's going on with regard to the plight of Palestinians at this moment?
Well, you know, we're talking today, Mark, partly to discuss Refaat El-Alir's life and his work. And a lot of us came to know him through an interview he did where he spoke against the backdrop of Israeli airstrikes, which are thundering behind him and all around him. And he speaks through tears. And he asks what the world wants Palestinians to do, to give up, to drown, to commit mass suicide. And he said very movingly in that interview, he said, you know, I'm an academic, I'm a professor, a poet. The most dangerous thing I have in my home is a marker. But if they come for me, if they come into my house, I will take that marker and I will throw it at the soldiers who have come to kill me. I think that at this point, to keep Gaza as it has been kept under a naval blockade, a land siege, there is no airport there, nothing can get in, nothing can get out. Everything from food to water, as we have seen, is controlled. You are not allowed to move freely, you are not allowed to speak freely, you are not allowed to engage freely. I don't quite understand what the world wants. That's in no way to justify violence. But when you push people against a wall, when you don't offer them a solution for their future, then they will take any option that is open to them. And that's not just in the case of Palestine. That's in the case of Ukraine. That's in the case of any people anywhere in the world. And it has been disturbing to see Ukrainian resistance valorized and celebrated in the West as noble and profound. And then the same kind of resistance when it happens to be practiced by brown people, demonized. When the media picked up footage of Ahed Tamimi, a young Palestinian woman standing up to an Israeli occupation soldier, they misunderstood her because she is blonde and, you know, fair-skinned, to be Ukrainian. And when the media at large thought Ahed Tamimi, a Palestinian girl, was a Ukrainian, they were almost enraptured by her bravery. The moment they found out she was Palestinian, that conversation was shut down. Either we don't condone violence, either we don't accept and valorize violence, or we do. And I've only ever seen it celebrated and accepted when it's white people doing it.
Another thing we've seen come out in the open since October 7th is a kind of hyper-visibility of women. Over the past three months, for example, there's been an emphasis on the visibility of women, Israeli women, at war with Gaza. There was a headline in the Times of Israel that read, "Squad of female IDF combat troops eliminated nearly 100 Hamas terrorists." While an article from the Australian Financial Review reported that, quote, "Israeli female-only tank crews made history on October 7th by fighting Hamas," emphasizing that the, quote, "slightly built soldiers showed no squeamishness at killing." This isn't exactly the feminist fantasy that many people envisioned.
It's absolutely not. And I really think it's beyond deranged to present hypersexualized female soldiers as some kind of feminism. It's not. It's crass, it's vulgar, and it's incredibly ugly for the message that it portrays. You can't claim feminism when you're killing Palestinian mothers. You can't claim feminism when your rifle is being aimed at a hospital. You can't claim feminism when there are children. 25,000 Palestinian children have been orphaned. That cannot be called a success of feminism.
Hmm. Another thing that happens a lot of times is now we see pinkwashing. I mean, on November 13th, I'm going to give you an example. Israel's official Twitter account posted a soldier, a photo of a soldier standing in front of a demolished Gaza. And the soldier was holding a pride flag with "In the name of love" written in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. And the post claimed that it was, quote, "the first ever pride flag raised in Gaza." When you see stuff like that, how do you respond?
Mark, I don't think there are enough words to convey the utter perversity to hold a pride flag over the scene of a massacre, over the scene of slaughter, and then claim some kind of ownership of love. I think it is the most obscene kind of pinkwashing. You know, let's also remember that same-sex marriage is not legal in Israel. Israelis have to go to another country to marry their partners if they happen to be queer, and then maybe they get that recognized in Israel, but it's not legal in Israel. And so to use queer language, symbolism, and history while they carry out what is essentially a carnage, it is the genocide of civilians, to use then pride flags and claim some kind of advancement is so perverse. I just don't think it can be taken seriously at all. And also, you know, what do they know about queer lives in Gaza or in the Middle East or in the Muslim world? Nothing. You know, they don't know anything about our lives. They don't even see us as human beings. And anyone who has any respect for queer politics, queer liberation, knows that you cannot tie that to apartheid. You cannot tie that to occupation.
Fatima, I want to think about justice, these kind of big picture ideas that we talk about. You know, what for you does it take to get there?
Well, you know, I think, again, as I'm not Palestinian, I can't claim to speak for anyone, but you cannot talk about justice while an occupation, a brutal occupation, is underway. And you cannot possibly talk about justice under the confines of a siege, of under apartheid. I certainly don't know, Mark, how there will be justice for these mothers who are giving birth under the most terrifying conditions that I can think of. I don't know what justice we can give those premature babies who were left to die because their hospitals were attacked. I don't know what justice we can ask for not just the journalists who have been murdered for telling us about this horror, but for their families who have been targeted and killed. I wouldn't even know where to begin there. I wouldn't even know how to ask. I think we also have to ask forgiveness, not just justice.
Fatima Bhutto, I want to thank you for sharing your views with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark.